Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Cheaper Than Therapy, a podcast that journeys into conversations that demystify, destigmatize, and desensitize what goes on both inside the therapy room and in daily life.
I'm Vanessa Bennett.
And I'm Danae Logan.
And we are seekers, soul sisters, and holders of sacred space. Every week, we sit down for soul-provoking conversations with fellow seekers, thought leaders, change makers, and even real people during live coaching sessions as they navigate the hard work it takes to be a human.
This is Cheaper Than Therapy. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Cheaper Than Therapy. We have one of our dear friends on the show today, and I feel like it was so nice to get to sit down with this person in person after like years now of being virtual friends.
I know. I love the ability to be IRL with people now, you know?
Right.
I mean, so much of our world is online and has been since 2020, and it was just such a treat that he happened to be out here and we had him over the house and just got to actually hug him and see him in person.
It's so funny when you meet people in person, like, see, Rainier's like a tall drink of water. And we were like, you're so tall, like would have never thought. But it's just funny when you've been talking to people virtually for so long, you have no concept of like those types of things, you know?
I know. And the conversation was so magical. I'm pretty sure we both cried a couple times, which is funny because I'm pretty sure last time we had Rainier on the show, I also cried.
I cried.
Yeah. So, that.
You will cry. Rainier will bring the waterworks.
Have the tissues with you because it's probably a crier.
Yeah. Well, but just a little background on our friend Rainier. Rainier is a highly sought-after mentor and consultant to authors, athletes, business professionals, coaches, healers, and ordinary radicals who want to see change in their world. He is known for his unique blend of spirituality and in-depth strategic coaching and is the author of As You Are, Meditations on Self and Other, and the co-host of Love Like Hell podcast.
Yeah, I think you guys are going to love this conversation. It's a deep dive into the book that he has been writing. And his writing is, if you don't follow him, please do, because his writing is profound. And we dive all into it in this conversation.
Yeah.
Enjoy. So we are beyond excited to have you in the house, literally in my house.
Literally.
Here in the flesh, IRL, in real life.
My God.
Before we started recording, we were saying, we're just talking about the book, which we'll get into more. But one of the things I was saying, I don't know if this is a good jump off or not, but it was kind of on the tip of my tongue. And I said, wait until we start recording to say it. So there's a part in the book in the very beginning where you talk about your dad, right? And I thought it was smart. I don't know if smart is the right word, but it felt powerful, and I will say smart, actually, where a book about love, the very first entryway into a book about love is about death and about loss.
Mm.
And I just, there was something about that that was so powerful to me because it was like, it reminds me of like this archetype of like the life, death, life mother, right? Or this concept of like, you can't have one without the other. You can't have dark without light. You can't have light without dark. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I want to start there. Like, was that something that you just like intuitively knew that you wanted to start it, kind of open it that way? Or did that come later?
Boy, it's so interesting even asking that question because I'm trying to reflect, like, how did I get there initially? But I was working on a collection of stories, which this kind of rolled into. And part of my idea was to talk about the stages of love. And when you, you know, track the stages of love, they're so optimistic. And I felt like they were missing something. For me, the thing they were missing was that every love begins with endings. Right? Even your first love. I have a son who is his first love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's delightful. But you know what's interesting is he is slipping away from his parents' home more and more. We see him less. And suddenly he's got ideas that they're not our ideas. They're coming from her. And I am so painfully aware that the beginning of this beautiful young love is coming at the cost of a relationship, of this parental mooring. And so even the first stages of the first loves start with endings, to say nothing of our very grown-up stages, right? And didn't I have to lose the last love to have this new connection? And
even the birth of your child. Any child, right? Isn't that an ending? I mean, because it's the death of, especially your first, it's kind of the death of self.
That's right.
In a way.
And so grief and joy, for me, are so intricately intertwined. And so when I went to write the introduction, the thing that had happened in my life last year was my father's passing.
Mm-hmm.
And as I sat down to write this book about love, it was so in the light of that huge ending and that huge outpouring of love.
Mm.
And it seemed like the fitting place to begin any kind of discussion, because that grief and that joy are intimately entwined, for me, at least.
Yeah, I feel like what I loved so much, Rainier, is it feels like somehow like a mature look at love, but that also feels like a sonnet to love. And I feel like you, there's a way that that's always your gift with writing. Like, you speak to things that are like the challenges, and you talk about like embracing love despite its impermanence. And there's something so potent about the way, even just now, you were talking about like the death of something, even when love is beginning, because I think there's like often a resistance to these truths that there is an impermanence and that there is a death of something. I think for so many of us, there's a resistance to the death of the version of self that I am when I am only thinking about me and my priorities and what I want. And we resist that, but we also resist the impermanent nature of love in the form that it's in. And we cling and we control and we manipulate. And a lot of times I'm always so struck by how immature we are in our like way of holding what it is to love someone, you know?
Yeah, you even call it like fantasy love.
That's right.
Right.
Well, and where do we get that fantasy love? I mean, when I reflect back on it, it's those moments, and be they preciously little, in our potentially insufficient childhoods, where we did have something that resembled unconditional love. Even if it was just for a moment, even if we had a neglected childhood or a scarcity childhood, there were undoubtedly moments where our caregivers created some kind of perhaps unreciprocated, or at least the need was unreciprocal, connection. And it felt so good. And I think a lot of us have been seeking that unconditional, unreciprocal love, fantasy love, ever since, hoping that our primary caregiver would come along in the form of beautiful woman, beautiful man, and we would be happy again.
Yep.
Yes.
And this is a fantasy, right? I learned it the hard way in my first marriage. I learned that you could not behave badly over and over and over and hope that someone would keep on showing up. They are not the deity, right? And we have to learn that at some point in time. So I think for me, part of the awareness of this is that love's impermanence, love's conditionality, is wrapped up in a mature and adult vision of it. Like, I have to show up and recognize not all love lasts. Every lovership ends. Every lover leaves.
Yeah.
Everyone dies. None of us make it out alive.
Yeah. I wrote a post a while ago about love being conditional, and I had so many responses to it that were trying to defend against this idea, right? Like, no, the concept of love is infinite. I'm like, yes, I get that. But what I'm saying is love between two adults, like a chosen, whether it's a partner or a friend, that's conditional, right? Like, we do have to act. I mean, I can love you, but I'm going to maybe decide that I have to love you from afar, right? There are conditions to that kind of love. You can't, for example, continue to show up poorly and expect somebody to always be there to receive it, right? And I don't think a lot of people want to realize that, because they want what you're saying, which is they want the parent. They want somebody who's going to come in and reparent them.
Right. And wouldn't it be nice? I mean, Hemingway ends his first novel with a exchange between the two main characters, and the female, the heroine character, says, oh, we could have been, and she rattles off this laundry list of what could have happened between them, and we could have done this, and it's all very flowery. It's very beautiful. And Hemingway has his main character look at her and say, what a pretty thought. And I love that. Like, sometimes I look at a lot of these things, and I go, what a pretty thought. You know, it's like, and there's an expiration to those pretty thoughts, and they haunt us. They hurt us when we buy into them. I think I would rather accept love's inevitable endings, love's conditionality. That is a much more beautiful form or vision of love to me. Once I can say this ends, God, then I treasure it. I have fallen in love with women at a coffee shop for 15 minutes of eye gazing. I mean, no joke. I was just looking over at them, and I was so inspired, and I would sit down in my journal and write some kind of beautiful sonnet and be so enamored with this stranger across a coffee shop who I will never see again. And that was a very weak and single-serving vision of love, and it ended. I didn't need it to continue. I could move on.
God, that's so interesting. And like, as you say that, I'm thinking about this idea of they are not the deity, right?
Yeah.
That you just said. There's this story you tell early in the book where you're, I don't remember how old you were, but like a little boy in school, and you were in love with this girl, and you tell the most beautiful story of like figuring out how to get some money together to buy her a necklace. And what I was so fascinated about as I was reading it is this idea of how we sort of make this person the deity. Like,
yeah,
you in your like childhood innocence, like you hadn't really talked to her about your love. The two of you didn't have like a shared understanding. And yet I was holding this vision of like what our experience and walking around the playground or whatever it was would be without sort of like, you know, what I'm, I guess, saying is like, it ends up being a projection that isn't really about that person so often, right? We meet someone and we start like going through like how this person is going to like solve all of these things, this unworthiness that I've felt for a lifetime. And a lot of times that has nothing to do with them, but we're like making them our higher power and imagining they're going to make us feel something that no human could possibly make another person feel, right?
That story is so delightful to me. I have a handful of them, and and all of which to say, it starts early.
Yes.
I mean, I was 7 in that story. And to recap, and I hope that people get around to reading this in the book, but oh my God, I adored, her name was Jackie. And I remember Jackie. She had big bangs, which was the style of the time. Like permed bangs,
yeah,
specifically.
Yeah. I'm a child of the 90s. I don't know those bangs.
Right? And long brown hair. And I remember her giant smile. And I loved her. I mean, whatever vision of love a 7-year-old is capable of, it was full on. And I'm drawing her name with hearts around it in my Trapper Keeper and mechanical pencil. And she doesn't know my name. I mean, she does not know who I am. And I got home one day, and my older brother, who's a decade older than me and was a bit of a shyster in my life, he was selling necklaces. And I don't know if they actually were 14-karat gold necklaces.
17-year-old dude.
Yeah, like opening his trench coat.
We would have been famous, haven't I?
I love it.
Great racket.
And, you know, I was like one of his first customers. And so he...
At seven.
But I don't have 30 bucks, you know. And he kind of leans in. I remember he says, well, you should get it. And so I don't know how I'm going to get it, but I remember that my parents have a vacation jar. And the vacation jar is where they put their change. And across a year, they will, you know, get enough money to rack up a little special holiday for us all. Well, this is a great place to siphon off money if one needs an extra $30 for this girl to have a gold necklace. So I steal $30 in quarters from my parents, which will later be found out. But in that moment, it was a great idea. And I take it to my brother, and he doesn't ask too many questions about where I got it from. And he hands me this necklace, and I put it in one of my father's envelopes that he uses for his business. And I think it even had its like mailing address on it. And I take it and I give it to her. She runs away. She still probably doesn't know my name. The next day, she's giving it back to me. And it was so sweet. I actually remember it as she hands the envelope back. And I say, why are you giving it back? And she says, well, my parents told me to. Which, you know, makes sense. Maybe a seven-year-old shouldn't be getting a gold necklace or whatever it was. And then I said, well, why would they make you give it back? Why? And she says, well, because I don't like you. And then she runs off, and I remember like a scene from a movie, the gold necklace just slipping from my hands, and I'm standing there with my heart, right? And this is one of those first rejections. A lot of times people ask, like, what are you really talking about with this book? Like, what are you trying to say? And I think the thing I'm trying to say is wrapped up right there, that a lot of love is wrapped up in fear. And we learn that fear early on, like fear that we're going to be rejected, fear that they won't love us back, fear that if I tell them the truth, they won't want me anymore, whether we're in a relationship or out of a relationship. And we learn that so fast. I think love is a tremendous risk, whether you're 7 or 70. That takes a lot of courage.
Like, even, God, there's so many thoughts as you're describing that story, and I'm dropping in and just feeling so much for this little boy who so early had this conceptualization that we all have, that, like, my love is something I have to...
I need to do something
to make you love me. And it's like this, like, not enough as I am wound that, like, all of us, mm-hmm. like, where does it come from? How do we, like, where do we learn that?
Why was like parents, right? I'm thinking, geez,
I'm like where did he even sure? seven? Who told him we need to barter, right?
What a delightful thing too. I mean, I think, like, what a sweet and innocent thought that. And there's another story, actually, which didn't make the book, but is equally painful in my early anxious attachment style, where I had marbles I had collected for quite some time, Steelies and Shinies and, you know, Aggies and the cat's eyes, you know, the kind that the late 90s or the late 80s was so abundant with. And I had collected them for a good while. And there was a girl, and again, I remember her name. This is second grade, named Lisa.
It's and a Lee, very 80s name.
Lee, oh, and Lisa. She had this beautiful, like, puffy vest that she would wear and this bowl haircut that she sported. And so, you know, again, a child of the 80s. And and every day she would reach into my bag of marbles and she would take one of them as a gift to her. And it was quite delightful. I mean, it was this wonderful exchange where I would get her presents in exchange for marble. And then I remember she reached in the bag and took the last marble. And it wasn't so much that I ran out of marbles. It was the thought that tomorrow she won't reach in the bag anymore. And she won't want to be with me. And I mean, I literally remember this agony coming over me thinking, there's nothing she wants of me anymore.
This is the visual representation, though. I mean, this is exactly what Danae was saying. Like, where does this start? I mean, there's beauty in it now. I think to be able to reflect on it in the innocence of it and, you know, the lessons that were learned and be able to almost feel into, because everybody listening can relate in some way to that feeling of that young, you know, desire. But I don't know, it's the therapist in me where I'm like, oh, like, that story though, right? And how does that continue on? And how does that kind of color, I suppose, the way you show up in love? I mean, you kind of jokingly said, like, oh, me and my anxious attachment, you know?
Well, and here's something I'm kind of interested to hear your perspective on, Rainier, since we have you, because I was watching something yesterday and we were sort of sharing it back and forth, a group of our girlfriends that we have, like, you know, how you like send reels on like a chat through Instagram. And it was basically they were studying a group of men, asking them, like, would you be with a woman who's more successful than you, right? And all of these men were like, oh, absolutely, I'd love it. Like, that would be amazing if a woman made more money than me or, like, had a more successful career.
Yeah.
And they put that same group of men in a room with women who made more money, had more successful careers, and all of a sudden, they all, like, were repelled, never more, that doesn't interest me, weren't engaging with these women. And I find it so interesting because, like, the point of the person who was sharing the reel was that, like, there's something in, like, the pain point for the masculine collective that I am what I can provide. And if I can't provide, what is, like, where is my worth, right? Yeah. And I think I felt a little of that is, and I get it, like, it is so beautiful and pure in, like, a 7-year-old boy. But I think something about, like, that collective programming hurts my heart a little bit for, like, my son and men, like, as they get older and think, I am what I can provide to a woman. Do you know what I mean?
Well, again, starting very early, as we're seeing, and perhaps that programming was right there from the very beginning. I think that one of the things that happens is we have that unconditional experience of a parental figure's love.
Mm.
And I don't think it has to last long. I think it has to last for all of one hug. And I think it's like the slot machines in Vegas or Reno. It's like you deposit one coin, you get a payoff. You get your $30 in nickels comes back to you. And then what do? You spend the rest of the day dropping nickels back in that machine until they're all gone. You spend all $30 when initially it was only one. So I think that actually what happens is we experience a modicum of love and affection from the places and the ways that we do. And then we keep seeking it, but it doesn't come wrapped up in a perfect package. Our parents weren't perfect and largely insufficient. I mean, all of us had insufficient childhoods, really. And so that belief in unconditional love that we keep seeking our whole life comes wrapped up in a lot of tricky behaviors, right? And so for me, it might be a preoccupied father, or a hyper available and yet slightly frightening mother. And so all of that then becomes what I seek from then on, right? I begin to seek that unconditional love plus the preoccupation. So then when I walk into a bar and I sit next to someone who is very available, very kind, very loving, very doting, like, something's kind of wrong with her, don't you think? What's wrong with that person?
I don't know why. I'm
but
just
I show up to the bar and I see the person and she won't look at me. She won't talk to me. I'm like, my God, that's the one I want.
It's all of us.
Right? And why? Why? Yeah. Because the tracks are laid.
That's right.
Right? Like the unconditional love got overlaid with the tracks of preoccupation.
Yeah, that's interesting, this idea of preoccupation. I was just thinking, like, okay, if I were to flip it and go more what my understanding for myself around being warm and avoidant is a little bit more what you were saying about the person at the bar, which is, for me, I don't actually want the person to be preoccupied. I actually want them to love me in a way that feels like my sense of self won't be exterminated.
Yeah.
And so because my experience of love is that in order to be loved, I can have a sense of self. That's what I look for, right? Or really what it is, I actually just reenact that wounding, right? And so it's funny because I'm thinking to myself, as like a kid, what would I do in that situation with the marbles? And I'm like, I'd be like, bitch, get your own marbles. Like, if it were like a little boy, for example,
right.
I can imagine being like, get out of here with that shit and can't have my marbles. But isn't it funny how like that, even at that age, I can very clearly in my body be like, hell no, I would never let that person have my marbles. It's so like the tracks
so
are
interesting.
So
interesting. Yeah, they're so entwined, aren't they?
I mean, I wouldn't want them to have it. I'd be like, no, get your own. These are mine. And it's not like a sharing mine. It's just like, it's like you're taking something from me.
God, I should have learned from you. You should have been my friend and defended me in that moment. I had no one and nothing. Well, but the truth was, you know, again, if I could psychoanalyze myself all the way back then, we had been moving. My family was We were moving relentlessly, kind of almost every year, every 3 years. I wasn't collecting a lot of friends.
Close friends, yeah.
I didn't have many relationships. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, when someone showed interest, it was so intoxicating, right? I needed that. And of course I needed that.
Sure, of course.
Like, that was actually my organism doing exactly what it should do to retain the tribe that was necessary. And this is one of my thoughts. I think that we pathologize a lot. And by the way, I can pathologize this with the best of them. And I certainly have spent a lot of my life doing it. But I think that one of the things that is painfully true, and increasingly so this last year, is I think that it all works out.
Mm.
And I feel so woo-woo even saying this, but it does go back to the death of my father last year.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my siblings and I had all these conspirators meetings about how we're going to care for him and all the really hard questions about what happens when the life support, you know, takes over and he can't do these things on his own and he's fading fast. Mm. And, you know, a week before he died, I had this very hard, difficult conversation with him where I pleaded with him to do what was necessary to stay alive for another decade. I mean, I was so optimistic, right? It didn't occur to me that even just a week later, he would be gone. So I spent an hour on the phone with him, pleading, cajoling, coercing, arguing, doing everything in my power to keep him around. And then my siblings and I had all of these times where we're talking. And you know what? I look back and I think how unnecessary those conversations were. How actually it was going to happen exactly as it was going to happen. If I have a regret, it's I just wish I would have talked to him for an hour. I just wish I would have listened to his stories. I wish I would have just sat at his bedside for that hour rather than arguing. And I think that life is going to take you where it needs to go.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that is where so many of us get wrecked in love, is that we think we need to coerce and control and resist life. And I think we get into a lot of trouble because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the point where you were talking about the end of your father's life and read, because I like wrote it down because I threw tears as I was reading it. But you said the little boy he had held so closely and also simultaneously the man who held him at a distance. And didn't we miss each other in these misaligned moments? And I thought how much that is true of love, that there are all of these moments where, God, especially like, I feel like I haven't heard someone talk about the complexity of parental love in the way that you wrote about it here. That a little bit of what Vanessa's saying, like that struggle to be a self. And that there's like so much of like our self that is wrapped up in like our parents' experience of us and some part of us still, as much as we can sort of intellectually understand things and create all of these like things that like distance us from our parents or like the ways that we pathologize them and their behavior, and still that child in us that just wants those moments you describe where we feel held and safe in the comfort of their gaze. And loved without condition, like all of us, I just believe, still hunger for that to some level.
Well, and you call it the paradox, right? I mean, this is the paradox of love. It's like what you say, it's like real love, true love requires the individual, and it also requires surrendering to this greater whole. And I don't think that's just in romantic love. I think that's any love, parental, friend, family, you know, otherwise, child.
I actually, this was really important to me when I set out to write a book on love. Because I think that, first of all, romantic love, when we say love, romantic love is king. In our culture, mm-hmm. I jokingly like to say, in the absence of God, we have made romance
to make
the
our
deity.
Partner the God. Yes.
Oh, that's right. And of course, the new order of priests or therapists and coaches and, and sin is, you know, our attachment disorders and, yes. And, you know, we need a savior to come in and help us. And it's usually our next partner.
Yeah.
And I think that how I wanted to understand love was not just romantic, but was familial, mm-hmm. platonic, even vocational, that actually love is, rightly understood, a transformational event, mm-hmm. in which I
actively surrender my selfhood to your goodwill in a process by which I will both merge with you and then unmerge with you in a successive series of waves, like waves on the shore. And so I will lose myself. I mean,
I can feel that. I can feel anxiety in my body, literally, when you say those words. And I've done a lot of work on myself.
Yes. Well, and actually, I mean, I want to speak to that in a few moments, because I think understanding attachment for me has become a bit of a nuanced thing. But but I think that wave of self to other, is actually the developmental stages of a relationship, any relationship. Mm-hmm. So I have a friend who's wrapped up in new love. And as his close friend, oh my God, I'm so concerned. He's losing himself. And I just rescued him from the last stand relationship.
We
just had our intervention, and now here we are. And you know, I kind of have to chuckle, because I go, and of course he's going to lose himself.
Mm.
And then I know what happens, because I've watched love happen a few times. He will find himself again. He will remember who he is. And then we will say, but remember, there's something great about her. Remember the first days when you fell, right? And so it's so funny how we go, the pendulum swings, waves upon a shore. I think that is the inevitability of love. We find ourselves, we lose ourselves, we find ourselves again, over and over.
Oof. Well, see, even like, and this is like always my premise, and I think I worked in addiction recovery before I became a therapist, and there's something about the way we talk about the intervention, and we lose ourselves in the like dopamine hits and to me, a lot of times it ends up being that obsession with the object and not about that person.
Yes.
Which also, in what you're saying, I don't know that I think it has to be that. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts, because I agree with the, like, I lose myself in the this love in service to, like, I believe love in its, I don't always say purest form, but is like, you make me want to be better.
Yeah.
You make me want to rise to like who I have the potential to be because I love you.
Yeah.
But the rising is the love, not the like, I am diminished. And I think so often it is like the diminishment of self. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I do. And so actually, you know, I think that love runs through a certain sequence of developmental stages.
Hmm.
And I simply don't think that you can skip the human condition. I don't think any of us arrived here fully formed. Neither do I think that love can simply develop into mature love.
Hmm.
Even if you're a great communicator, even if you're like, I'm showing all of my red flags at once so you can know me. And I think it does simply take its course. Mm-hmm. And so that first stage, I fundamentally believe union is the first stage. My job, my organism is doing its work to get up off of the couch and blend my life with another. That is my evolutionary impulse.
Mm.
Otherwise, I will remain in my comfortable isolation. And so you are...
That was aggressive. You saw that, right?
But the funny thing is, as I turned, you turned away, because you knew a turn was coming.
Oh, man.
For those not watching, but listening, I just aggressively... Listened.
Carry on, please, Rainier.
Oh, man. I feel like I walked into something. But I think that first stage of union is so necessary. Now, the discomfort that the two of you or one of you just showed, I think
she's got her own version of it. Don't let her.
I think it's important. And so here I want to talk about attachment and potentially attachment disordering. I think at its core, ambiguity and our ability to sit with ambiguity is wrapped up in almost every one of the attachment insecurities we talk about. For instance, someone may feel real insecure at that first stage of love. Oh, it might produce all kinds of insecurity. The ambiguity of, do they like me? Do they really care? Do they want to have union with me? So we might call that stage anxious. And why are they so anxious? Because the beginning stages of love feel too uncertain. So my anxious attachment is not so much an anxious attachment as much as it is the insecurity around the first stage of love, the ambiguity of the first stage. Someone later down the road, say in the second or third stage of love, which might be a little more even merging, and they're like, oh my God, I'm going to blend myself with this person. the uncertainty that that would create in me, well, we might call that person a little more avoidant in nature, right? But we each have uncertainty at different stages in this, right? And so that inability to sit with ambiguity, uncertainty is at its core our attachment disordering, right? And so if I look at those stages, you know, the first stage is union. The second stage, which lasts, I think, forever for a lot of couples, is collusion. Mm-hmm. It's like, I met your mask. Your mask was wonderful. Your mask was all the best. Mm-hmm. And I really fell in love with that mask, who you were saying you were and who you always are. And now that we're together, I need you to always be the person you said you were. You can't change, and you have to be the same, and I have to be the same, and we collude with each other to keep the illusion alive. The third stage of love would be disillusion, and that can happen in the first week, or that can take a 10-year toll, you know. All of a sudden, the masks come off. Mm-hmm. I've shared with you guys before, and Christy, my partner, was on the podcast. We shared a powerful disillusion moment where I confess infidelity to her. And didn't the masks fall off in that moment? Didn't there arrive an opportunity to see one another as we were? So many couples have this. It could be over the dishes. Oh my God, he's an asshole who doesn't like to do the dishes. Or it could be something like infidelity or integrity or big things, small things. The masks come off. The fourth stage of love is possible only after disillusionment. And that is communion, which is not just union. It's union after the masks have fallen off. And so I think that what you're talking about, Danae, earlier, this idea of, do we have to like lose ourselves? In the end, no. In the end, I believe a mature love, the definition of a mature love is a love that makes you more of a self, not less. But I think that happens in the span of a timeline, be it in a moment, a week, or 50 years. I think it's progressive in nature.
And what I think is so interesting about this, again, curious to hear your thoughts, because I think when I work with couples who are like on their second and third marriage or a little bit older, I think some of that, and this is why I think it's so fascinating that you writing about love in the context of death, I think some of that ambiguity gets a little bit knocked out of us, like our like inability to sit in it once we've sat through some of the like, I'm going to die. Because a lot of times the like thing that we're looking for in that other person is that higher power, is that like relief from the existential angst. And it's like once we sort of say like, they're going to be human because human's going to human. And I'm sort of signing up for this deal with another human. But it feels like some of that feels easier. And of course, like it's real easy from my couch. And I get that, Vanessa, before you start to say it. But I'm joking. But some of that I do feel like the expectations I have as a woman in my 40s are so much lower than they were in my earlier years of attempting to love someone. And I don't know, in some ways that feels like the gift of a little bit of loss, you know?
I think that once you realize the end is coming and that you're going to lose them and there's no perfect relationships because there are no perfect people and there are no perfect situations and everything, even the best of connections involve pain. Mm. Once you accept that, I think that you really can get on with the business of loving someone. Mm. So I do agree. I think that there is a certain degree of maturity that may come with age. Mm. You know, I remember driving with my dad. One of my favorite stories of him, and this has no relevance on what we're talking about, but maybe it has all the relevance. You know, my dad and I had such a complicated relationship. Most children I know have complicated relationships with their parents, but... Mm. But, you know, I was in my mid-30s and I decided I would take a road trip to a business conference in Las Vegas. And I forgot that it was February and that there are mountain passes between Oregon and Nevada. And it just didn't occur to me that my little Honda or my Toyota Prius might not be equipped to go through those mountain passes.
And I had not been on a significant road trip in many years, which is why I thought it would be a great idea. And so I take off my Prius, and then I forget to actually have a map outside of my iPhone. It doesn't occur to me to have. So I was greatly unprepared, except I did have a lot of snacks in the car. That was the only thing I was prepared
on. That's the tourist in
there,
by the way.
Totally.
It takes one to know on my phone.
Oh my God. All the snacks. I also had a playlist.
We'll figure it out as we go.
Literally thinking you would have snacks.
And my music was great. Yep, my set lists were amazing.
Music and the stats.
And so here I am. And then the signal goes out.
Yep.
And so I actually don't know where I am on the map. I haven't seen a car in 2 hours. I'm now headed into a blizzard and I'm terrified. And I get about one bar on my phone, and my dad had spent his lifetime as a minister traveling from camp meetings and revivals to churches. He's what I like to call a driver. And as a driver, he stayed calm. And I knew who to call. As a man in my mid-30s, I'm going to call my dad, who my relationship isn't all that great with. But I say, Dad, I'm in the middle of a blizzard. Would you think about just talking me through it? You know, he stayed on that line for 6 hours. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly sweet. He just talked me through that whole thing. And then as I got closer to Vegas, he said, "Hey, kiddo, I don't have plans this weekend. Can I just fly down to you and drive you back?" You know, there's not too many moments when your elderly father can rescue your grown-ass adult self. And so we spent the next 3 days driving back and talking about all of these things. And I just got 3 beautiful days where I could just ask my dad just about everything about his life. And I decided I'm just going to use these 3 days and make him uncomfortable. It was the greatest gift. And I really don't know why I'm telling you that story, except to just say, I think that there was this moment when I said, "Dad, you know, you're not the dad I remember. Like, I kind of remember you as an angry father, and you're not." And he said, "Oh, I'd like to say I did a lot of work, and I'd like to say I went to a lot of therapy, and I read a lot of good books, but the truth is that I think this might be the sanctification of aging." Mm-hmm. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I just think I just paid attention to life across the years, and I let it just age me a little and temper me a little." Boy, I have a lot of hope in that. Like, if we just hang on long enough and pay attention to life long enough and listen to it long enough that it might temper us, we get so wrapped up in needing to make all the changes and all the moments. But
I'm like,
yeah,
God, there. It's a little bit, you know, we keep talking about it's not just romantic love, right? Like, these stages of love are in any love, right? I'm thinking about how last few times there's been something that's gone on, complicated relationship with my mother. And John has been the one from the outside to say, "I don't think your mom is who you remember her to be." Hmm. I think you're seeing your mom through the lens of how you used to see your mom, like who she used to be. And I get it, right? But I think you need to let go of that, because I think you're missing who she is. I think you're missing who's in front of you. And it's just like, as you say that, she's still who she is at her core. It'll pop up every now and then. But she has even said to me, like, "I'm just too old to care that much anymore. Like, too old to be that angry. I'm too old." And when you were saying the anger thing, I was like, God, that's it. It was like the remembrance that I had of her was the anger. And I think so much of that is what caused this complicated relationship. And I am still in relationship with that version of her. I left at 18. I never went back. And it takes somebody like outside, I think, sometimes also, or an experience like you had. And my mom and I just went to Paris last year for her birthday. I took her for her 60th, and I had such an amazing time. And I was so like leery of it the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to cry saying this. I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. And what you're saying is so powerful, because like, you're missing it. You know? Yeah, I'm here. You're better than I just cry.
Rainier, like, just know we're going to cry when Rainier comes on the podcast. It's just a given. That's what's going to happen.
Well, it is that line that you read, Danae, and if you have it pulled up, if you might read it again, my half, read that line, you know, the one you, yeah.
And didn't we miss each other? Misaligned moments? Is that? Yeah. God. And that's so all of our loves, all of our relationships. Like, I'm so struck often when I'm sitting with couples, how they're just like missing each other because there's a story that is about someone other than the person sitting in front of them that they're telling, that they're defending against. And it's like, you're not actually like with each other in this moment. You're just missing each other.
And so I think actually this is such a beautiful gift that you're giving by sharing your experience, because crash all of those things into my father's deathbed. And here I am now knowing that I have moments with him left. And the beauty of the sorrow of that is just so wrapped up. And my father was just this tremendous orator, but at the very end, he couldn't speak anymore. And it took a while to realize that he was tapping his fingers to try and tell us things because he couldn't say it otherwise. And boy, you start to think, what would you do if it was your last smile? If you knew that you were so weak that you actually had to squeak out this next word and you may not get another one, who do you give this last handhold to? How do you parse out those moments? And I tell you, the last couple of years of my father's life, I had to draw some boundaries, and I did some things I thought were pretty damned important, you know, to preserve my selfhood, to, again, kind of move into that autonomy, that autonomous space where I am my own man, damn it. Can't you see who I am? All of those necessary distinctions faded in that moment. They just evaporated. It did not matter what diagnosis I had given him. It did not matter the boundary of self I thought I needed to have. Those things evaporated. There was only withness. I think the stories that we hold, that you talked about, that hold us, you know, we think we have ideas. Ideas have us. And I think that in that moment, it was so dissolving, where you simply see naked truth, naked reality. So when I went to write this book, part of what I wanted to do was smash our faces up into these scenarios of, well, fathers and sons, relationships. One of the stories is a couple, and she's on her deathbed. And he is kind of taking care of her. And there's implications that he's making amends for things that he might have done in the past. And then, you know, it's like, well, what happens when our faces get smashed up against the micro moments of life? I think that what happens is we lose our clear-cut definitions of right and wrong and what should be and what shouldn't be. And we're left with simply standing there in that living room or that bedroom or in Paris, and we're going like, oh my God, who is this person? Can I just experience them in this moment? That's what I wanted to communicate in all of this. Not a lot of pretty thoughts or good ideas, just the experience of being in love, whether it's with a father or a mother or a child or your lover.
I don't even know your dad, but the way that you talk about him, and then the way that the ideas come through you as if you're channeling, I imagine that you are much like him.
Thank you. That was an oddity, actually. I ended up reading a eulogy at one of his two funerals, and it was so funny. It was just how many people who had known him, and he had been a significant person in his world, oratorically, and people came up and like, oh my God, you are so much like your father. And it was actually such a beautiful gift to receive that people don't die. They live on through us. Relationships that we lose, they don't really go away. They teach us. Even bad relationships. I'm so struck. People are like, oh my God, that toxic relationship, that horrible relationship, it ruined everything, I think. But didn't you learn? Wasn't that your teacher? I just take an agnostic view to the ideas of good and bad, and that actually everything can become our teacher if we let it, including the most excruciating things.
I have more love, or more, I shouldn't say more love. I have more capacity to tap into the love that I actually felt, even in the moment, for my ex-fiance than I was ever capable of at the time. But it is. I mean, yes, it can be, someone could say it's hindsight, but I have such like a reverence for who that relationship made me become or helped me become, or the lessons that I learned, that my love for that man runs so deep. And I swear it's deeper now than it was even when I was with him.
Oof. That is,
and it was
a
quote unquote toxic relationship, right? But God, I mean, the love is so deep.
I would love if my exes said that about me. I don't think they're going to.
I don't think he feels the same way. But that's the other thing. I don't need him to.
Yeah, that's
right. Of course,
right.
I would love him to, right? But I don't need him to. I'm able to kind of like extend that energetically without an expectation, I suppose, of return.
And what a grace.
What a grace to ourselves, to someone else, that you can look back and you can say, yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so struck. You know, there's another moment in that same thing I was reading about those final moments with your father, where I was thinking about like what changes as we become a parent in terms of our relationship to our parents. And mm-hmm. I think there's just, you know, my little boy is 6 and there are all of these ways that I start to see him really like becoming a little bit more differentiated and a little bit more of a self. And like, he'll say something to like remind me of that. And I'll be like, oh, right. You're your own little person. Right. And like your father in those final moments, like you describing him seeing this little boy, I think there's just such a, you know, my little boy will do this thing sometimes where he'll just be like, mommy, come be with me, you know, just like be with me. And there's something about like how we have this inability to just be with each other mm-hmm. without an agenda and a narrative. And that is like what I think a little bit of distance gives us sometimes mm-hmm. is just to like be with who that person was, but it can be hard up close.
It is so difficult. And you know, I love, and I'm sitting here with other parents, and I think that there is something so beautiful when you become a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if you have to become a parent of a child. I think you can become a parent of a piece of art, a parent of an organization or a project. But when you pour your heart and soul into something, and you actually do have those moments where you realize, oh my God, I can be with this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about getting it right. It's not about demanding some kind of rigid perfectionism. And it takes a long time. And God, I know that you don't always even get there, but we have those glimmers. And so then if I can borrow against that truth that I think at least all of us sitting in this room have had maybe towards our own children in moments, you know, if I can borrow against that moment and bring that into, say, romantic love and go, do I have to have this rigid expectation of this person? Do I have to expect that they will agree with me all the time? And I think one of the things that I'm most amused by these days is this idea of compatibility. and recently I actually posted something about compatibility where I said, like, actually, we negotiate for compatibility. Compatibility is created. Today, these days, it gets talked about like it's a fortune telling session. And it's like, you're either compatible or you're not. And I can, you know, predict reasonably that we are not forever. It's like, well, actually, I think we create compatibility.
Mm.
I think that we sit with someone and we negotiate those spaces and we say, what can I live with? What can't I live with? What about you and what about me merge into something new? And, I mean, I think chemistry happens all at once, but I think that compatibility emerges over time and we go, oh, this was worth it.
I love this idea of negotiation versus compromise. Because I know that Danae feels similar. Like I struggle with the word compromise,
yeah.
Right? In relationships, because to me it feels like if I have to compromise, I have to give something of myself up, right?
Yes.
And again, avoid in here.
Yeah.
That's hard for me. I'm very clear. But this idea of negotiation, that actually feels so powerful to me, because yes, like being in any relationship, true, intimate, vulnerable relationship, I don't care what kind of relationship that is going to require negotiation. It is. And I think that we're kidding ourselves if we actually don't think that that's part of it, right?
Yeah.
But I'm going to start using that because that feels so resonant in my body, whereas I feel like the term compromise makes me kind of shut down a little bit. I have to toy with that a little bit.
I would argue a lot of times the negotiation is with myself and the story I'm telling myself about who this person needs to be.
Yeah, amen.
Like, I think so much of what has been so, like, an education for me in loving is actually my relationship with Vanessa. Mm-hmm. Because on, like, paper, we might not be compatible. We are so different in our experience of the world. But what she has taught me is what it is to, like, that two people can hold with such reverence how you experience the world and what that brings into my life, mm-hmm. that I might not always have as my first response. And I think so often, like, that's what we're attracted to in someone, is that you experience the world differently than me, but I need you to be different so that I can believe that we're compatible. And it's like, but is that true? Like, why is it true? Can I be in the negotiation around the story I'm telling myself around this person needs to be a certain way for me to exhale?
That's powerful, right? Because basically what you're saying is, like, if chemistry is something that kind of happens, right? It's unspoken, it's energetic, it's other lifetimes, right? There's things that we just will never be able to articulate or understand about why and what chemistry is, right? Like, you and I had immediate chemistry. There was a knowing, like, we've done this before, no question, right? But if we, it's like chemistry and compatibility, how do I articulate the, it's like, I look at somebody and I say, oh my God, we have so much chemistry, but we're not compatible. And so I might walk away, right? But the compatibility, what we're all saying right now, is actually a negotiation sometimes, whether that's with self, whether that's with the other person, whether that's with the dynamic, whatever. And if we don't, I suppose, take the risk on or do the work of the negotiation, we're actually letting slip something that is potentially larger than us, right? Mm. Which is that, like, spark of, you were drawn into my life for a reason. I was drawn to you for a reason. That in and of itself is chemistry. Mm-hmm. And if I get so caught up in the, but we're different, we're not compatible, because to your point, on paper, one would say that we're not.
Yeah.
Then I'm missing the opportunity to be in union with somebody who actually I truly am compatible with. It just doesn't look like it on paper.
Yeah.
Right.
And actually, what's so beautiful, even if we use this example, is that something completely new came out of these two, let's just call it potentially incompatible people, but a third and new and previously unknown thing now was born. And I think that's the truly exciting part. You talk about losing self in the other. Well, part of what actually happens is we both dissolve ourselves into a greater identity or organismic reality, which is the relationship itself.
Yes.
Right. And so I think that's a really beautiful truth. You said something earlier that makes me think of a lot of people lose the plot line, though, early on. Mm. So for me, I know when I've lost the plot line. I have boiled it down. I have distilled it down to a couple of key statements.
Mm.
And it seems to happen anytime I have gotten into love with, quote, the wrong person. And I'll tell you what it is. It's going really good. Maybe we met at that bar, or it's a text and it's just, oh, it's feeling so great. And then there's this line from one or the other. Who are you? I mean, really, who are you? And what are we? Now, this could happen in the first hour or the first week, but it usually happens suddenly and upfront. And it's that question of what is this? And so what I actually think can happen very early on is I stop looking at you, you stop looking at me, and now we're engaged with the possibility of the connection. And we cease to actually see the person in front of us, and we begin to borrow against a potential future. You know, don't date on potential. This is that moment. But it's not the potential of you. It's the potential of us. And that initiates an immense amount of dopamine. My dopamine goes off the charts when I imagine that we could be the most amazing thing ever, the best business partners, the greatest family members, the best lovers. And all of a sudden now I have this expansive emotional experience. And that's where the addiction starts.
Oof.
My emotional intensity now ratchets up, but it's not really about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's about this possible connection. I think that is a very cheap addiction that happens early on, and we do not get addicted to that person. We get addicted to the emotional intensity itself. That fuel runs out pretty quick. For one thing, because actually positivity, positive things actually deplete fairly fast. So then you have to start looking for other fuel sources besides positive potential. Then you start to look for problems to solve. So I feel like the second phase of like the emotional intensity cycle is like, I'm looking for problems to solve because problem solving makes us feel really good as a species. So I can maintain my emotional intensity, which is what my real addiction is too.
Mm-hmm.
I can maintain it by solving problems endlessly. So then you hear like, well, God, if our parents just understood us, or if we could just live closer together, how can we problem solve? Couples can live in the problem-solving addiction part of that cycle for a long time, and that fuels their relationship. Still not based around you and me, based around the us. We're problem-solving our connection. Third stage, because that fuel source runs out, pathologizing stage. The problems run out and you become the problem, or I become the problem. Now, that fuel source is abundant because like it's easy to think negatively of someone, actually, who you're smelling their dirty laundry a lot. And it's also a very dirty fuel source. It becomes corrosive. And at the end of a lot of relationships, what I observe happening is people who were addicted to the emotional intensity up front, still addicted to the emotional intensity at the end, but it no longer feels very good. It's like you just did a lot of crystal meth, and it's like it's keeping you up at night, which you enjoy, but it feels like hell to your body system.
God, it's so fascinating. So I read something in A Course in Miracles once, and I'm going to butcher exactly how they say it. But basically what they were saying that feels really in alignment with what you just described was people talk about like when you fall in love with someone, you're falling in love with like their representative or not their true self. But basically what they were saying, that's not true. When you first meet someone and you're in that space of discovery, that is them. That is like the self. And then all of this that you're describing gets in there. And then I leave them. I leave us. I am in the story that is in the future that, you know, the worthiness, the dopamine surge of what this could be. But initially, it's just two people discovering each other. And that is actually the truest version of self, right?
That's it.
And I mean, there's a way that you talk about it in terms of like you, how did you say it? When I was young, I said that love felt like fear, right? And I think that's like, to me, that's what you're describing a little bit in what you just said, right? Like, I'm trying to like do something to contain the fear or be in negotiation around the fear.
I love that you just said fear. And I kind of smirked when earlier when you were telling the story and then you said, and that produces a lot of, and you paused and my mind went anxiety. And you went, you went dopamine. And I smiled because I was like, oh, wow, I took that in a different direction.
Which if you look at what's firing in the brain, it's probably not that dissimilar.
And not to like, again, not to pathologize it, but what you've got a little bit more of the anxious kind of vibe versus a little bit more of the avoidant vibe. I think they're both producing dopamine, but I think for me, my story, it's the anxiety of like, oh, no, that actually produces it. Whereas somebody who might be more of the like little anxious lean in, it's the other version of that that produces the dopamine. But I had to smile because I was like, oh, that's not where he went with
that. Well, it's all fear.
But when you said either way, I was like, oh, that's what that is for me. But that's also what that is for you.
And then that's why I really actually believe whichever side of the coin you fall on, one of the most underrated skills in relationship is just your ability to tolerate distress.
Totally.
Like your ability to simply sit with uncertainty, your ability to sit with ambiguity, your ability to have courage in the face of fear, right? And I really think that societally we could just pause there and talk about that as its own thing. But I think a lot of people come and they're like, how do I not be afraid? Recently, someone just said that, like, do you ever even experience fear anymore, Rainier? And I'm like, all the time.
Still
like,
human.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, I haven't ascended yet. But like, you know, I mean, like, but the reality for me is I don't think a lot of life is going to be without fear.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will be with fear. That's courage. My God. And I think that love feels like fear to a lot of us.
Yes.
Whether at the beginning stage or at the merging stage or like fear comes in.
Yeah.
How will I sit with it? How will I engage with it? And then if I allow it to inform me,
because I've done my work, because I've actually learned how to regulate myself within that and to pause and make a wise-minded decision, then I suddenly have options and I can make something that's effective to my long-term goals.
Oof. You're so wise, right?
If only it translated into some areas in life, but...
Self-deprecation. Everybody needs to read this damn book is what they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, like the editors that were reading the book and just a lot of people feeling like you were killing their ideas of love and that that it's just like they found your book sad. And I really experienced what you wrote differently. And you said, like, there's an order to this. Love is made of the debris of other loves. And I love the idea of like, no, this is just like us having an adult conversation about what this is versus allowing all of these, what's the word I'm looking for? I was thinking like a depth word too, but like all of these other fears to take over and not like really be grounded. And yes, we're going to be, well, maybe, we're going to be afraid. That's the price of entry into this beautiful thing called being alive and experiencing it through the other. And we're going to be afraid.
I mean, I think this book is a profoundly existential vision of life and love. It begins with the understanding that we lose everything. Mm. And I think that, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre was asked in an interview, the father of French existentialism was asked if he suffered from despair. And I think he truthfully answered, I have never, a day in my life, suffered from despair. And if you look at least the French existentialists, separate from the American existentialists, the French existentialists seem to have this vibrancy about them. They're living these incredibly delighted, champagne-filled lives. Well, why? Like, they have such a nihilist vision of the world. Well, it's wrapped up in this sentence that Heidegger is actually attributed to, where it's like, life is meaningless and empty. And it is empty and meaningless that it is empty and meaningless. So someone may say, oh my God, it's so hopeless that you would say that life has no meaning. He said, well, stop making meaning out of it, actually. You're making meaning out of meaninglessness. But rightly understood, it is a blank canvas.
Yeah, it gets exciting.
Oh my God, that's when it's delightful.
Liberating, right?
Exactly. And so if I understand that there's an end, if I start there to life, to love, to lovership, then I can enjoy it. You know, the gods are jealous of humans because humans live so short. Right? That means we have to cram it all in. You know, my youngest son, Mercer, is something of a soccer player. And I love watching him play soccer. And one of the reasons why I love watching him play soccer is because he plays all out. And this one particular soccer game was a good moment for both of us. And he scored 4 goals straight out of the gate. I mean, just went in, zing, zang. And the coach, being a kind-hearted coach, pulled my son to give equal playing time to the other players. Well, the other team caught up and then scored 2 extra. So now it's 6-4. Last 2 minutes of the game, Mercer is just chomping at the bit. He's just like, put me in, coach, put me in. And it's raining and the field is muddy. And the coach looks at him and says, get in there, kid. And I'm like, yes. And my son gets the ball on the pitch and is running down the field, score. Now it's 5-6. He actually then gets the ball again in a miraculous moment to tie it up when the other kid trips him. I mean, it was a clear trip. It was a violation if I've ever seen it. My son tumbles into the mud. The ball goes past him. The other team grabs the ball, runs it down, scores the next goal. They win. They win. My son gets up, tears are streaming down his muddy little face, and comes over, and I get to hug him. I say, but you played your heart out.
Yeah, you did.
Now, what I love about that moment is that is life. We don't win this game. We don't win the game. But you will be judged according to how you played. Did you play your heart out? Did you give your everything? Even when you fell in the mud, did you get back up? You may not have been carried out in the arms of cheerleaders, but you can walk away with your shoulders held back, your head held high. I think that is life, but that is also love. Did I love all out? Did I show up knowing I might not have gotten a great return on the love? Is a bad investment. I mean, if you just look at it from a dollars and cents sign, I mean, a lot of us likely took out to dinner and spent $200 on someone we might never see again. Did you have a good dinner at least? I mean, can it be okay? So I think like that's the first part of this book. The second part of this book is courage over fear. Like it takes courage to get up in the mornings. A courageous approach to life in the face of fear. I think the last part of this book that I think is profoundly existentialist for me is time. The degree to which we experience the subjective reality of time is the degree to which we allow ourselves to love. Whether it's a moment, and I allow myself this 30-second in loveness with this person across the room that I will never see again, or it's 55 years. Time is so subjective, and the degree to which I realize my place as a being in time is the degree to which I allow myself to love. So I hope that people experience this as somewhat liberating to go, I want to play all out.
And then it certainly is for me, and I'm so grateful for you, my friend, that I just think getting to know you in this lifetime is such a sacred gift, truly. I've been so impacted by so many things that you've said and written. You are like, I'm going to count one of those wise sage teachers to me. And thank you for just like the way you show up and leave it all on the dance floor.
You are more than welcome. And I, you know, even when I hear that, Danae, like coming from you and you, Vanessa, and just sitting here, and I sit here and I sometimes think like, how the hell am I here? Like, how is this my life? Like, Blake said, the road of excess led to the palaces of wisdom. And so like, what is wisdom?
Yeah.
Like, I think wisdom is just you paid attention to life.
Mm-hmm. I think that's it. You got that skill, though, I think, and you're teaching people to do the same. You know, I think there's something connecting the three of us in this room, and then I would even probably say John, who's not in the room, which is I think that all of us strive to show up as somebody who's not preaching at you, but is saying, I'm here doing this too. Look, I just fell in the mud. Let me talk about it. Let me show you the mud. Let me show you the scars, right? I'm not afraid of it. I'm not ashamed of it. I hold it close as part of the experience, and it's important to do so. And there is a little bit of me that wonders if that is some of that energetic connection, is that I think that even maybe in an unspoken way or now a spoken way, I think all of us have a reverence for that and try our best to emulate that or to show up in that way. And I think to Danae's point, it's like learning so much from you, but I think there's a part of you, it's not just the words, it's the way you're like, no, this is me. This I'm doing this thing. That is how I learn, right? It's the beautiful words, but it's also in going, yeah, but I saw in those words, I see that you just did that thing and you're muddy right now.
Uh-huh.
You know?
The thing that this week has been so beautiful for me is getting to connect to you guys, and there's a few other friends here in LA, and I wrote back to my wife, Christy, who couldn't join me this trip, even though I really wanted her to, but we were texting back and forth, and I said, it's so interesting because I feel so, and I used an interesting word, I feel so beloved. I feel like I'm getting loved on a little by these people I'm connecting to. And I said, and I recognize the path here. And she said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I know how I got here. And she said, what do you mean? I said, it was just the day I decided to be a self in this world, to just show up as myself. Mm-hmm. I had been doing so many things to avoid being a self in this world, masks and all these different kinds of things. But the minute I showed up and said, no, this is me, all the faults, the failures, the foibles, the insecurities, it's all me.
Mm.
I think you can finally be loved when you show yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And until then, I think you can have a rough go of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for gracing us with your presence. We're so grateful to get you in the flesh.
Thank you.
Way to not miss your flight.
Thank you. Yes, it's probably also been, you know LA better than I do. So.
The mama in me is like looking at my clock going, I get to the airport, my friend.
That's great. Okay.
Ew.
Thank you for letting me hang out here.
When does the book actually come out?
The date is mid-April. Pre-orders February 10.
Okay, y'all. It's happening.
So this is soon. Okay.
Pre-orders, yeah.
Let's get you.
So it will happen, and it's so exciting. Yeah, I can't wait. Honestly, I'm so nervous about this. I've been so nervous, and even like hearing you guys say that you're enjoying it,
yeah.
I just honestly, there's so much of me in this book. Like, yeah. It's not teaching. It's like, it isn't separate from myself.
Vulnerable.
Oh my gosh.
And so.
Ooh, love against time, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Cheaper Than Therapy.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And if you want to connect with us more, find us on Instagram at Cheaper Than Therapy, the podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.